Let's start with the idea of a startup economy. Why is that a viable option for Binghamton, and how could that possibly replace the large industries that have left?
If you're an entrepreneur, you can create a job for yourself, but you can create a job for a bunch of your friends as well. And that's how we grow the economy. It's particularly important, I think, in areas such as upstate New York, where we had a huge number of extremely successful companies. I mean, it's like the who's who of the Fortune 500. You have the, you know, the GEs, the Westinghouse, the Cornings, the Kodaks, the Bosch and Lomb's, the Xeroxes, the IBMs, the Link Simulator. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And they're all basically gone now. I mean, or they're a shell of themselves. They start out as a startup, they ramp up, they kind of peak, and then they ramp back down. We have a huge number of companies in upstate New York who are at the end of their life cycle rather than the beginning. But we had so many of those large companies that the pipeline, for some reason, stopped. There wasn't this pipeline of hundreds of small, young companies ramping up, which would become mid-sized companies, which would become large companies. So for every 100 companies you start, maybe one of them will become a large company, or maybe it takes 1,000 to create one large company. But you have to have that pipeline.
And what exactly do you mean by a startup company?
We're not necessarily talking about a 7-Eleven on the corner, you know, McDonald's franchise. You know, those, you know, small businesses are important to a region, but they don't grow a region economically. You start a restaurant, a franchise, say a McDonald's here in town. People go there and they buy lunch or they buy breakfast, they buy dinner. And some of that goes to people who work in this community as salary, but a chunk of it disappears and goes off to McDonald's headquarters. Okay, so you're siphoning money out of the region. You're not growing the region. If we start a Walmart here in Binghamton, okay, these Walmarts are all over the country, all over the world. People go to Walmart, and then a fraction of those dollars come back to Binghamton. And so that investment is leveraged.
It seems like every small city talks about becoming the next Silicon Valley. Do you think Binghamton needs to create a unique identity that would work here?
It's a fascinating question that gets a lot of debate, and there's been a fair amount of research. The essence seems to be you can't do that. You can't create a cluster. So entrepreneurs create clusters. Clusters don't create entrepreneurs. So the thing to do is create as many entrepreneurs as you can, and they will probably self-organize and certain clusters will develop. But if you say, here's where we're going to be strong, and you try to push that area, what you're doing is you're taking money away from the area that was most likely going to develop and become strong. And we know we're not smart enough to guess the answer.
Do you see any advantages in the Binghamton area?
The huge advantage that Binghamton has, a couple of them. One is our geographic location. You can't draw a 300-mile circle around Binghamton, and that's 25% of the population of the U.S. and more than half the population of Canada within 300 miles of Binghamton. And we have five interstates, you know, pouring into here. So we're kind of this little very small rural area that is really well positioned. We're 150 miles or so from the center of finance, the world center of finance. Up here, 100 square feet, you can probably get for free. So young people are going to be making no money on this startup. You know, the salaries are close to zero. So you have to be in a place where you can get space for free. You have a lot of young people who have essentially no living costs, who have no commitments, because it's hard to commit to something that is probably going to fail. If you're married, you have a house, you have a mortgage, you have kids, you have any of those things, it's pretty hard to commit to something that's likely going to fail.
During his career, Ken McLeod has developed 12 products that have been taken to market, specializing in what's known as translational research. Professor McLeod, would you describe this specialty?
I pick research questions that I do believe can be commercialized rather than we would have a category of research, for example, called blue sky. I want to know this because the world will be a better place if I know how this works. A classic question of blue sky research would be, why is the sky blue? Okay, and in fact, a famous physicist came up with a wonderful solution at the end of the 19th century on why the sky is blue. What do you do with that information? I mean, it's cool to know that you can explain why the sky is blue, except for in Binghamton, where the sky is usually gray. But in the rest of the world, the sky is often blue in midday, and there's a theory behind that. So that's basic research. We take research results from around the world and recombine these. So translational research is learning the process of recombining extant ideas or extant technologies, putting them together in new ways.
But it seems like the university is the only place where that blue sky research can take place. Why do you focus on translational research?
It's just a fundamentally, in my mind, a fundamentally different process. And both are equally important. I think Aristotle said it. If we're all philosophers, who's going to fix our plumbing, right? If all we know is how to do blue sky research, who's going to create the next generation of products? And I think that's really, in a way, what has happened here is, as academia has taken over more and more of the basic research and corporate America has shut down its basic research labs. You know, GM doesn't run a very big, I think Microsoft does, they're one of the exceptions. But most of the big companies, the GMs, the AT&Ts, all of those have shut down their research labs. They say, you know, if we want basic research done, we'll go to academia. And so we have been doing more and more basic research and the application stuff has been pushed to the side. And so these young PhDs, master's students, whatever, get out there, and they don't know how to do translational research. They can't create the products of the future because no one's taught them how to do it.
Your career path has taken you a long way from where you started in the 1970s. What is your academic background, and how did you come to develop products used in the healthcare industry?
My background is in engineering, specifically electrical engineering. I entered the workforce working in the auto industry. I actually designed machinery to make automobiles. We call it production engineering. And there was a lot of interest in the auto industry, which was struggling to automate. Most jobs in the country are created by startups. Obviously, there's nobody working. You create a startup, and there's more people working now. So if we have lots and lots of startups, we have lots and lots of people working. Big industry is kind of the opposite of that. The whole trick in big industry is maximize shareholder value. And so you want to reduce employment as much as possible. So the question is, can we replace this job done by a human with a machine? And that's what I was doing at the time. We were trying to do a lot of things by creating smart machinery, what we call machine vision, machine intelligence. So I was working in production engineering. We're moving into the realm of machine intelligence. And so I went off to graduate school to study machine intelligence. And at least in the 70s, the idea was, well, if you're going to make an intelligent machine, you kind of have to understand what intelligence is. You have to understand what makes people intelligent, what gives people the ability to see pattern, do pattern recognition, that kind of a thing. So I started studying physiology. And then I just drifted and drifted. I never went back to machine intelligence. I am focused on human intelligence, human vision, moved on into adaptation and repair of tissue. And I never went back.
That was Binghamton University professor Ken McLeod. In Binghamton, I'm Matt Richman for the Innovation Trail.